Hello, and welcome to today's episode of Sleuthy Stories. If you're new here, this is the podcast where real-life mysteries unfold, one clue at a time. The audio for today's story has been pulled from my main YouTube channel and remastered for this podcast experience. If you'd like to see the visuals that accompany this case, head over to my YouTube channel, Sleuthy Lucy. But for now, sit back, listen closely, and let's unravel the mystery together. Thanks for being here. Well, hello, and welcome back. I'm so glad you're here with me today. If you haven't already, be sure to hit follow so you never miss an episode. Today's case is one that will stay with you long after it ends, a truly heartbreaking story. We're talking about Sharonda White Clark, a 20-year-old mother of two little girls, just 4 and 2 years old. This case isn't just about loss, it's about the unimaginable. What happened to Sharonda didn't just steal a mother away from her children. It left behind questions, heartbreak, and circumstances so shocking, they'll likely leave you feeling angry and unsettled. It's a case that's both devastating and important to tell. So, let's dive in. The world was glued to their televisions. The O.J. Simpson trial had turned the courtroom into a spectacle, and the country was divided over what justice should look like. But in Tulsa, Oklahoma, as headlines fixated on the trial of the century, a different story was unfolding. One that wouldn't make national news, but would leave behind a trail of heartbreak and devastation. Tulsa in the mid-90s was a city straddling two worlds, one of small-town familiarity, the other of rising crime. Homicide rates had crept higher year after year, and for many, safety felt like a fading memory. Still, for working parents like 20-year-old Sharonda Clark, life revolved around routine. Work, daycare pickups, and making it home in time to tuck her little girls into bed. The sun has just set, leaving a dull, gray glow on the horizon. The temperature hovered at a chilly 41 degrees, and a crisp breeze rustled the few remaining leaves clinging to bare tree branches. At exactly 6 p.m., daycare workers at a local childcare center began their end-of-day routine. Parents bustled in, gathering their children, exchanging pleasantries, and heading home to begin their nightly rituals. But as the minutes ticked by, one child remained unclaimed. Then another. The clock struck 6:15, then 6:30. Two little girls, 4 years old and 2 years old, sat waiting. The caregiver, trying to remain calm, glances at the sign-out sheet. The name missing? Sharonda Clark. Sharonda was like clockwork. A devoted mother who never left her daughters waiting. But tonight, she was nowhere to be found. Sharonda's friend, Jackie, was the next name on the emergency contact list. The moment she heard that Sharonda hadn't picked up the girls, her heart sank. This wasn't just a forgotten errand. It was a warning sign. Something was wrong. Jackie rushes to the daycare, scooping up the two confused children. On her way home, she dials Sharonda's number. No answer. In 1995, cell phones weren't common. If you needed to reach someone, you had a few options, a landline or a pager. But Sharonda was one who had a mobile phone at that time and still wasn't returning calls. And for Jackie, that silence was deafening. By now, her parents and grandmother were pacing. This wasn't just unlike Sharonda. It was impossible. She wouldn't vanish. She wouldn't leave her daughters stranded. Hours passed, still no word from Sharonda. The landline remains silent, and the concern turned into full-blown fear.
What's your emergency?
My friend Sharonda Clark is missing. This isn't like her at all. With no way to contact her and no explanation for her absence, Jackie did the only thing left to do. She called the police. Officers were immediately dispatched to 6246 East 36th Street, Sharonda's apartment. But when they arrived, they found something that only deepened the mystery.
Police, anyone home? No sign of the resident. Apartment secured.
10-4.
No sign of the resident. Apartment secured. Sharonda Clark had vanished into thin air. It had been 24 hours. 24 agonizing hours since Sharonda White Clark was last seen. 24 hours since her young daughters sat waiting at daycare for the mother who never came. And now, her closest friends and family were gripped by the fear that something was terribly wrong. Knocks to Sharonda's door and calls to her phone went unanswered. Over and over, the same response: silence. It was the only way to reach her, and now it was as if she had vanished into thin air. By this time, the kids were in the care of their grandmother, and Jackie had been calling around, hoping someone, anyone, had heard from her. But no one had. Sharonda's friends were becoming aware of her disappearance. Since it had been 24 hours since anyone heard from Sharonda, her grandmother took the necessary step and filed a missing persons report, hoping that, somehow, there was a reasonable explanation. But with each passing hour, that hope faded. Jackie and Sharonda's friend and neighbor Sheena had no choice. They needed help. They called the police and asked for a welfare check at Sharonda's apartment. Tulsa police officers were dispatched to the Normandy apartments. It was around 12:40 p.m. when officers arrived. As the squad cars approached the complex, Jackie and Sheena stood by, watching, their breath shallow, their hands trembling. Their minds raced with possibilities, but nothing could have prepared them for what was inside. The apartment door was locked, but when officers knocked, there was no answer. They announced themselves. No response. Forcing the door open, it creaked on its hinges, revealing a dimly lit apartment cloaked in silence. At first glance, the space appeared disheveled, but not entirely alarming. Couch cushions lay scattered across the floor, and a spilled cup of Kool-Aid had dried into a dark, sticky stain on the carpet. But as the officers moved deeper inside, the unsettling calm began to crack. Signs of chaos emerged. Furniture slightly askew. Small items knocked over, as if someone had fled in a hurry, or had been forced to. The deeper they ventured, the more the apartment resembled the aftermath of a violent struggle, the kind you'd expect to see in a horror film, rather than the quiet stillness of everyday life. Trying to catch a glimpse inside, Sheena leaned closer, her eyes darting across the room. The disarray hit her immediately. Cushions strewn across the floor. Scattered belongings that didn't seem to belong where they lay. Something felt wrong. The air was thick with unease, as if the apartment itself was holding its breath. The officers continued cautiously through the living room, each step measured and deliberate. Then, without warning, they froze. Their bodies tensed, holding their positions as they scanned every shadowed corner. Something in the atmosphere shifted. Too still. Too silent. The quiet wasn't peaceful. It was suffocating. One officer suddenly stopped in his tracks, his breath catching in his throat. Without exchanging a word, he signaled to his partner. Together, they retreated toward the entryway, their instincts sharpening like a blade. Hands hovered near their holsters, ready for the worst. Then, with a brief nod of silent agreement, they re-entered, weapons drawn. As the last officer stepped inside, he quietly shut the door behind them, cutting off any retreat. Whatever was waiting in that apartment, they were now fully committed to facing it. They pressed forward, moving slowly down the narrow hallway. That's when they saw it. Blood. It was everywhere. Splattered on the walls, smeared along the floorboards, each mark a silent witness to the violence that had unfolded. When they reached the southwest bedroom, the scene grew even more harrowing. Blood streaked the walls in jagged, desperate lines. A shattered window's jagged edges caught the dim light like tiny shards of glass teeth. The bedsheets were twisted, half pulled from the mattress, as if someone had struggled with everything they had to escape. The chaos wasn't random. This was ground zero, the heart of a violent struggle. Then the officers saw a trail of blood, a thick, dark smear winding away from the bedroom leading toward the bathroom. They hesitated. The air felt heavier now, thick with dread. Their instincts screamed in unison. This was no ordinary missing persons case. And there, they found her. Sharonda's lifeless body, beaten and plagued with stab wounds to her neck and chest, laying on the bathroom floor. Born on a crisp fall day in Kansas City, Kansas, Sharonda White Clark came into the world with a spirit as bright as the autumn leaves that surrounded her. She was beautiful, vibrant, and full of life, known for her infectious energy and warm heart. But above all else, she was a devoted mother, a role she embraced with unwavering love and dedication. Sharonda became a mother at just 14 years old, a life-changing moment that came with immense challenges. Her parents had dreams for her, ones that didn't include teen motherhood. But despite their initial concerns, she was determined to raise her daughter with love. The father of her child, just 15 himself, was in over his head, and the weight of young parenthood was overwhelming. Still, Sharonda wasn't alone. She had an incredible support system, a network of family and friends who rallied around her, working together to provide supplies, childcare, and encouragement. It wasn't easy. She had to quit school to care for her baby, taking on odd jobs to make ends meet. But she never once saw motherhood as a burden. She adored her daughter. Sharonda was an active, hands-on mother, always engaged and present. She lived for her little girl, pouring all of her energy into giving her the best life possible. In the spring of 1992, love found her again. Sharonda became pregnant with her second child, another baby girl. The father, Travis, was different. He was deeply in love with Sharonda, and for a while, their young romance burned brightly. They married, full of hope for the future. She was a teen mom, and now a teen wife. But life has a way of testing even the strongest bonds. After about a year, their marriage ended. They were simply too young. Still, Sharonda and Travis remained close friends, co-parenting their daughter with mutual respect. But Sharonda was never one to let a setback define her. She worked hard and soon climbed the ranks to become a manager. Her friend Sheena recalled how Sharonda hustled, working at stores in Fontana Shopping Center and Anthony's Clothing Store before finally accepting a management position at a store in Eastland Mall. It was a huge step forward, a symbol of her growing independence. According to her oldest daughter, she had her own place, paid her own bills, and fiercely protected her and her younger sister. Sharonda's brother described his sister as a firecracker, someone who would never back down when it came to her babies. Despite her responsibilities, Sharonda always made time for her girls. She worked two jobs and rarely went out. On warm days, she would sit on the porch, watching her girls ride their bikes, smiling as their laughter filled the air. Sharonda was young, ambitious, and had little time for romance. But in 1993, love found her again, in the most unexpected place. She met 23-year-old Jermaine Cannon at his brother's funeral. Sharonda had always been a source of comfort for others, and in Jermaine's grief, she became a shoulder to lean on. She made him laugh in the middle of his sorrow, and for a man searching for solace, that meant everything. Their friendship blossomed into something more. Jermaine was drawn to her compassion, her bright light. And she, though cautious, was open to love again. She wasn't in a rush, but for the first time in a long while, she felt hopeful about the future. But that future was cut short. On February 5th, 1995, her friends and family, desperate after 24 hours of silence, called the police. Officers entered her apartment and discovered her lifeless body beaten and marred with stab wounds on the bathroom floor. The woman who had fought so hard for her future, who had given everything to her daughters, who had touched the lives of so many, was gone. Just past 12:40 p.m., the Normandy apartments had become the epicenter of what was no longer a missing persons case. This was now a confirmed homicide. Officers had entered a scene straight from a nightmare. Blood was everywhere, smeared across the kitchen floor, splattered on the living room carpet, and staining the hallway. Faint shoe prints left trails of crimson in every direction, silent evidence of a violent struggle. In the narrow hallway leading to the bathroom, Sharonda Clark's body lay sprawled on her back. The young mother of two was lifeless, her skin pale against the dark stains around her. Stab wounds marked her neck and chest, each one a sign of ferocious violence. Smaller cuts laced her hands and arms, the unmistakable marks of someone who had fought back with everything she had. A broken knife, its handle separated from the blade and coated in blood, lay near her body. To the detectives, this was more than just a murder weapon. It was a sign of pure rage. As homicide detectives arrived, officers worked swiftly to secure the apartment. Evidence was tagged, bagged, and cataloged. Every shoe print, every smear of blood was meticulously recorded. But for the detectives, two haunting questions loomed over the chaos. Who could do such a thing? And why would anyone commit such a heinous act against someone like Sharonda Clark? The detectives began their search for answers by moving deeper into the apartment. The trail of blood led them straight to the southwest bedroom, where the true horror of the attack became clear. The room was pure chaos. Blood spattered the walls in violent arcs, each streak telling a story of relentless struggle. The bedsheets were shredded, yanked from the mattress, and the furniture had been knocked out of place. From the spatter patterns on the walls and the trail leading into the hallway, the detectives quickly formed their first theory. The attack had started here. Sharonda had been stabbed, again and again, until the room was soaked in her blood. Then, she had been dragged out of the bedroom, her body leaving a grim trail as she was pulled into the hallway toward the bathroom where she was left for dead. Then, detectives noticed the broken window in the bedroom. At first glance, it seemed like the obvious sign of a break-in gone wrong. But closer inspection revealed something that shifted their theory entirely. The glass shards were mostly outside the room, not inside. The window had been shattered from within. If this had been a robbery, why was nothing missing? There were no signs of forced entry, and valuable items were untouched. For the detectives, these details told a different story, one far more personal. The evidence suggested something chilling. Sharonda had likely known her killer. She had let them into her home. And the violence, the sheer brutality of the attack, pointed to something even darker. In their experience, when a perpetrator chooses a knife instead of a gun, it's rarely random. It's not about theft, it's about rage. It's personal. As detectives pieced together the fragments of that fateful night, new questions began to surface. The scene was violent, but deliberate. Brutal, yet targeted. Who could have harbored such rage toward Sharonda Clark? And what could have driven them to destroy the life of a young mother with such merciless intent? The answers would soon reveal a story far darker than anyone could have imagined. Now came the part no detective ever wanted to face, breaking the news. It was their duty to inform Sharonda Clark's family that the woman they loved, the devoted mother of two little girls, was gone. The detectives pulled up in front of Sharonda's family home, the weight of their task pressing down on them like lead. There was no easy way to say what needed to be said, no words that could soften the blow. They didn't call. News like this couldn't be delivered over the phone. The knock at the door was met with hesitation. Sharonda's father answered, his face shifting from confusion to dread as he noticed the badges. Without a word, he knew something was wrong, terribly wrong. The detectives spoke gently, their words carefully measured. But no matter how delicately they broke the news, the result was the same. Devastation. Sharonda's father, who had always been the family's pillar of strength, crumbled under the weight of the news. His grief was raw, his sobs deep and unrelenting. For those who knew him, it was a side of him they had never seen before. His daughter was gone, and there was nothing he could do to bring her back. Word spread quickly through Sharonda's close-knit circle. Her friends, those who had shared her joys, struggles, and dreams, were left in disbelief. How could someone who spent her life lifting the spirits of those around her meet such a tragic, violent end? Even her young child, 4-year-old Ye Shen, felt the sudden, devastating absence of her mother. Though too young to fully comprehend what had happened, Yeshen's life was sent into a spiral. The foundation of her world had been ripped away, leaving behind confusion and heartbreak that no child should ever have to endure. As detectives stood quietly in the background, they watched grief consume the family. Tears, anguished cries, and whispered memories filled the air. Through the family's pain, detectives began gathering context. The way Sharonda's father asked, "Who could do this?" with genuine bewilderment, told them something important. This wasn't a family entangled in dangerous connections or hidden conflicts. This was a family caught entirely off guard by the senseless brutality of the crime. Friends shared stories of Sharonda's warmth and strength. No one could imagine her having enemies, let alone someone capable of committing such a heinous act. For the detectives, the family's devastation offered a painful reminder of why their work mattered. But it also left them with a haunting realization. This wasn't a random act of violence. This was personal. As the family began to grapple with their unimaginable loss, the detectives returned to the scene, their resolve hardening with each unanswered question. While Sharonda's family mourned the unthinkable, detectives knew their work was only beginning. The morning after Sharonda Clark's murder, detectives were already back on the scene. The apartment was now secure, but the unanswered questions weighed heavily on everyone involved. As light poured into the blood-stained rooms, the full gravity of the crime became clearer. With a homicide confirmed, detectives had only two burning questions. Who could do this? And why would anyone commit such a heinous act against someone like Sharonda Clark? Detectives wasted no time canvassing the neighborhood, knocking on every door around the Normandy apartments. Most residents were stunned by the news. Sharonda was known for her kindness, a young mother who got along with everyone. One neighbor, a friend of Sharonda's, confirmed what everyone else was saying. Sharonda was well-liked and respected in the community. No one could imagine why someone would hurt her. But this friend had noticed something strange the day Sharonda disappeared, Friday, February 3rd. She had been returning home from the store when she spotted Sharonda outside, talking to a young man. The conversation wasn't friendly. It was heated. They were arguing, and Sharonda appeared visibly upset. The neighbor didn't recognize the man, but his body language raised alarm bells. She described him as a black man in his 20s, though she couldn't see his face clearly from the distance. Later that day, around 5:30 p.m., the neighbor tried calling Sharonda to check on her. After several rings, someone finally answered, but it wasn't Sharonda. It was a man's voice. Cold, short, and dismissive. When she asked for Sharonda, he told her she wasn't home. But then she heard something chilling. Sharonda's voice in the background. Before she could ask another question, the line went dead. The detectives immediately flagged this unknown man as their primary suspect. Who was he? Was he the same man Sharonda had been seen arguing with? But detectives also knew that crimes like these often involved those closest to the victim. They soon learned that Sharonda had recently separated from Travis, the father of her youngest daughter. Though their breakup had been amicable, detectives couldn't rule him out without asking tough questions. Was it possible there were unresolved tensions? Could jealousy or custody disputes have driven him to violence? Detectives quickly located Travis, but their suspicions were short-lived. Not only was Travis cooperative, but he also had a solid alibi. He had moved to Ohio following his breakup with Sharonda and hadn't returned to Tulsa since. His relationship with her had remained friendly, and they were successfully co-parenting from a distance. With Travis eliminated as a suspect, detectives found themselves back at square one. With few leads, detectives subpoenaed Sharonda's phone and bank records, hoping for any clue, an unusual withdrawal, a suspicious call. But the records turned up nothing. Forensic testing on the knife found near her body also led nowhere. The murder weapon was smeared with blood, obscuring any clear fingerprints that could have been lifted. Frustration began to mount. The investigation was barely underway, but every lead seemed to dissolve into dead ends. That was until a friend of Sharonda's came forward with a chilling revelation. Sharonda's friend told detectives that she had been seeing someone, Jermaine Cannon, a man she met at his brother's funeral. They had grown close quickly, and by all appearances, they seemed happy together. But then, something changed. Without warning, Jermaine vanished. Months passed without a word, leaving Sharonda heartbroken and confused. Just as she was beginning to move on, Jermaine suddenly appeared at her door in January 1995, as if nothing had happened. His sudden return raised red flags for Sharonda, but his charm and apologies wore down her defenses. Against her better judgment, she let him stay. It wasn't long before her doubts resurfaced. Sharonda confided in her friends. She couldn't ignore the feeling that Jermaine was hiding something. So, she pressed him on the issue. That's when, according to her friend, Jermaine finally confessed the truth. He hadn't just disappeared. He had been in prison. And worse, he had escaped. When detectives ran Jermaine Cannon's background, they uncovered a terrifying history. In 1991, Jermaine was convicted of attempted murder after a brutal attack on an 18-year-old woman. He had broken into her apartment, sexually assaulted her, and then tried to kill her, choking her unconscious and beating her head and face with a claw hammer, an iron, and a toaster. She survived, but the attack left her permanently disfigured. The count of sexual assault was dismissed in a plea agreement. The case was delayed while Jermaine underwent evaluation at Eastern State Hospital, where he was found legally competent to stand trial. An unrelated case, alleging that Jermaine burglarized an ex-girlfriend's apartment and assaulted her while trying to keep her quiet, was also dismissed. After pleading no contest to the charges, Jermaine was sentenced to 15 years in prison. But his transfer to a lower security facility gave him the freedom he needed to escape and returned to Tulsa, straight into Sharonda's life. Detectives now had a clear theory. Jermaine liked preying on women. And when Sharonda had discovered the truth, she was preparing to kick him out of her home. The argument outside her apartment, the male voice answering her friend's phone call, the escalating tension, it all pointed back to Jermaine Cannon. As detectives pieced together Sharonda's final days, the clues aligned with chilling precision. The man seen arguing with her on February 3rd, likely Cannon. The voice on the phone? Cannon. The fear Sharonda had confided in her friends? All connected to him. Now, detectives had a new question. Where was Jermaine Cannon now? And could they catch him before he hurts someone else? Detectives were now determined to find Jermaine. Every lead pointed toward him as Sharonda's killer, but there was one problem. No one had seen him since before Sharonda's disappearance. The investigation had seemingly hit another dead end. Just as frustration began to mount, a surprising call came in, one that would completely change the course of the investigation. The woman on the line asked for the lead detective by name. Her voice was hesitant, but determined. She introduced herself as Jermaine's mother. She had put the pieces together. Though she didn't know the full extent of what her son had done, she knew he was in trouble. And now, she had information that could help bring him in. Jermaine had called her. She was shocked. He wasn't supposed to be free. He was supposed to be in prison. She told them that Jermaine had left for Flint, Michigan. When detectives asked why Jermaine would flee to Flint, she revealed a critical detail. His uncle lived there. It was a place where he could hide, surrounded by family who might not ask questions. According to his mother, Jermaine had tried to convince her he was innocent, saying, "The police are after me for something I didn't do." He admitted to his mother that he had gotten into a fight with Sharonda, but insisted it wasn't what it looked like. Caught in a heartbreaking situation, his mother pleaded with him to turn himself in. Deep down, she feared what he was capable of. Betty told the detectives that she had asked her son why he didn't just leave after taking the knife from Sharonda. He replied, "I just went crazy on her." With this new information, detectives wasted no time. They contacted authorities in Flint, Michigan, and prepared to arrest Jermaine. But just as they were setting their plan into motion, another call came. This time from Jermaine himself, using a cell phone that was later determined to have been stolen from Sharonda's apartment. Jermaine's family had convinced him to come forward. Over the phone, he told detectives he wanted to share his side of the story. Within hours, detectives were sitting across from him, ready to listen, but also prepared for lies. Jermaine began with his prison escape, explaining how he had stolen a truck and made his way back to Tulsa. He claimed he went straight to Sharonda because he believed they shared a real connection. Desperate for a place to hide, he thought she would help him. But the reunion quickly soured. According to Jermaine, Sharonda began questioning him about his disappearance. He described her as nagging and said tensions boiled over. The relationship, once hopeful, turned bitter. Then came the argument. He claimed that when he told her he planned to leave her, she spiraled out of control. According to Jermaine, Sharonda attacked him with a knife, forcing him to defend himself. He said they struggled, shattering the window in the process. He alleged that she lunged at him again, cutting him as they fought. He claimed he managed to wrestle the knife away, stabbing her in self-defense. He told detectives he tried to help her afterward, dragging her into the hallway to get her to the bathroom, only to realize she was already dead. Knowing he was a wanted man, Jermaine said he didn't call for help. Instead, he borrowed money, bought a bus ticket, and fled to Flint, Michigan on February 5th to stay with his uncle. Throughout his story, he never admitted fault, painting Sharonda as the aggressor. the one responsible for the violent struggle. Detectives didn't buy his story. The evidence at the crime scene told a different tale. Sharonda had defensive wounds on her hands and arms, proof she had tried to fight off an attacker. Blood spatter patterns suggested she had tried to escape, not attack. When detectives inspected his body, Jermaine, on the other hand, had no defensive wounds, not even a single scratch. His claims of being cut during the struggle were completely unsupported by the forensic evidence. Detectives were convinced Sharonda Clark was the true victim and Jermaine Cannon was her killer. On February 6th, Jermaine was arrested in Flint, Michigan, on charges related to his escape, and was held at the Genesee County Jail, where he begged to be brought back to Oklahoma. According to officers, Jermaine didn't seem to appreciate the hospitality there. He was extradited back to Tulsa on February 19th, where he was officially booked, processed, and charged with first-degree murder. As Jermaine awaited trial, detectives reflected on the tragic reality of the case. A young mother's life was stolen by a man she once trusted, someone she had welcomed into her home, only to be betrayed in the worst possible way. The case was far from over. Now, it was up to the courts to determine Cannon's fate. For Sharonda's family, friends, and especially her two young daughters, the arrest brought a measure of relief, but it couldn't undo the loss they had suffered. The question now was simple, yet haunting. Would justice truly be served for Sharonda White Clark? On March 12, 1996, nearly a year after Sharonda Clark's brutal murder, the trial of Jermaine Montale Cannon began. The weight of the tragedy hung heavily over the courtroom, each person present, ready to bear witness to the fight for justice. For Sharonda's family, it was the first time they would come face to face with the man accused of taking her life. Tears welled in their eyes, but they remained strong, determined to see the process through to the end. The prosecution wasted no time laying out its case. They detailed how, on January 13th, Jermaine Cannon escaped from the Walters Community Work Center, a low-security facility near Lawton. He then stole a truck owned by the Walters school system and returned to Tulsa. The truck was found abandoned on January 19th near Yale Avenue and 41st Street. The day he showed up at Sharonda Clark's door was the day he fled from prison. He had returned, seeking refuge with the woman who had once comforted him. The motive, they argued, was as clear as it was devastating. Sharonda had asked Jermaine to leave her home. After weeks of giving him shelter, after learning of his prison escape, she was ready to end things. But for Jermaine, leaving wasn't an option. Instead of packing his bag and preparing to walk away, Jermaine's rage boiled over. Prosecutors described how he pursued her through the apartment, trying to beat her into submission. When that didn't work, he grabbed a knife from the kitchen. Sharonda ran from room to room, desperate to escape. But Cannon caught her. The prosecution detailed the chilling sequence of violence. Sharonda was stabbed 4 times. One blow severed her jugular vein, and the fatal strike, a stab to the chest, took her life. The apartment bore witness to her struggle. Bloodstains on the walls, overturned furniture, and signs of a desperate fight for survival. Throughout the trial, Jermaine remained cold and expressionless, often smiling, a sight that horrified Sharonda's family. The defense, sticking closely to Jermaine's earlier statements, painted him as the victim. They claimed Sharonda was the aggressor, that she had attacked him first, and that he acted in self-defense. But the evidence told a different story, one of calculated violence, not self-preservation. Jermaine showed no defensive wounds. Meanwhile, Sharonda's hands were covered in cuts, proof of her desperate attempts to fight him off. Each time Jermaine smiled or displayed his cocky demeanor, the pain for Sharonda's family deepened. His lack of remorse was undeniable. After days of emotional testimony and mounting evidence, the jury was handed the task of deciding Cannon's fate. It took them just 2 hours to reach a verdict, guilty of first-degree murder. As the words were read aloud in the courtroom, a wave of relief washed over Sharonda's family. There were tears, embraces, and quiet sobs, a mixture of sorrow and justice finally served. But the trial wasn't over yet. In the sentencing phase, the jury delivered its final decision, the death penalty. For Sharonda's family, the sentence offered some closure, but it couldn't bring back the daughter, mother, and friend they had lost. Still, they knew her fight had not been in vain.
The state of Oklahoma will execute a man this morning who escaped from prison, then stabbed a Tulsa mother of two to death 28 years ago.
Jemaine Cannon was sentenced to death in 1996 for the brutal killing of 20-year-old Sharonda Clark.
Jemaine Cannon has been on death row for nearly 3 decades now and still maintains his innocence, saying he acted in self-defense. Sharonda Clark's family says Cannon robbed them of their time with her, and they're getting their justice today. Now, prosecutors say Cannon escaped from prison back in 1995, where he was serving 15 years for attacking an 18-year-old woman. Cannon was initially put in a minimum security prison, then was assigned to a community work center, and that's when he escaped. Investigators say Cannon had been living with Sharonda Clark since his escape until they found her dead in her apartment in February of 95. Cannon was arrested for the murder 2 days later in Michigan. Sharonda was supposed to pick up her two young daughters from daycare that day, but never showed up. Family called police and they later found her dead with several stab wounds to the neck. Cannon has said for 28 years now that Clark came at him with the knife and he defended himself, but prosecutors say the evidence doesn't back up his claim. The Pardon and Parole Board denied Cannon's clemency last month. Now, Cannon is set to be executed at 10 o'clock this morning. It'll be the state's 9th execution since 2021.
Nearly 30 years would pass before the sentence was carried out. Jemaine Cannon fought to delay the inevitable, filing appeal after appeal.
Now, police say in Clark's apartment in 1995, there were signs of a violent struggle. Even last month, before the Pardon and Parole Board denied him clemency, he claimed that his actions were all in self-defense.
Put yourself in my shoes at the moment and what was going on. I didn't know that I was going to be attacked by Sharonda. No, it caught me completely off guard.
The Oklahoma Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty told us Cannon suffers from PTSD and was abused as a child. It also stated that killing Cannon was not justice, it's cruelty. Now, we've also heard from the victim's family back at that Pardon and Parole Board meeting back in June, and they are just heartbroken over their loss and ready to see justice take place.
But on July 20th, 2023, justice was finally served. That day, Cannon was served his final meal. Cherry pie, chicken breast, sliced brisket, seasoned fries, fried okra, barbecued meats, and a Vernors ginger ale. A stark reminder of a luxury Sharonda Clark would never again experience.
The family of a murdered Tulsa woman says that they're grateful the killer has been executed because he never showed any remorse. Jemaine Cannon was pronounced dead at 10:13 a.m. in McAllister.
In front of the media, dignitaries, and what appeared to be family, Jemaine Cannon made a brief statement, prayed with his pastor, nodded at several people in the audience, gave a thumbs up, and closed his eyes only minutes later.
Sharonda's family was there to witness his execution, hoping for some final sign of remorse. But none came. Instead of acknowledging them, Jemaine locked eyes with someone else in the room, a person he knew. He smiled, waved, mouthed, "I love you," and gave a thumbs up. The officers asked if he had any final words. His response was self-serving, a final act of dismissiveness. "Yes. I confess with my mouth and believe in my heart that God raised Jesus from the dead. Therefore, I am saved. Thank you." There was no apology, no acknowledgement of Sharonda or the family he had shattered.
feel like you finally got your justice today?
I don't necessarily want to use the word justice, but I do feel like justice was rendered in the way that it should have been. There's no justice for replacing a life or taking a life. However, it was what was necessary, if that makes sense. In my opinion, he died in a very favorable way that a lot of people in good health would request or prefer to die when it is their time. He died in his peace. Unfortunately, my mom did not have that opportunity. He was allowed to say his goodbyes, read lips, give thumbs up. It was peaceful for him. I didn't expect it. He hasn't shown any remorse in 28 years. Not at one point in time has he offered a sincere apology. Not at one point in time has he offered a sincere apology to the family or just repenting what he's actually done for himself. So I didn't expect it. It was the reaction that we got through his last words was definitely selfish, and that's been how he's been the entire time. So it was expected for myself. I don't know.
What would you say to your mom? What do you think?
I would start by saying we did it. We did it. We were your voice. We stood for you when you could not stand. We continued to fight your fight when you could no longer. So I would say she was not defeated. She may not be here in flesh. However, she is still here within me, within her sister, within our family. So we did it.
And what's next for you?
This is the start of a new journey, a new chapter, not only for myself and for my family, but also for the other survivor victims. We can now easily breathe at ease. To know that this is finally done, there's no more escaping, there's no more possibilities. That's what puts us at ease. And I think I speak for not only myself, but also for those other survivor victims.
What do you think about this tragic case? Sharonda White Clark's story is one of resilience, love, and an unbreakable dedication to her children. She was a young mother who faced life's challenges head on, determined to build a stable future for her daughters. But her trust and compassion were ultimately betrayed by someone she once cared for, someone who took her kindness and turned it into vulnerability. This case is a painful reminder of how easily predators can disguise themselves as loved ones. For Sharonda, the tragedy wasn't just about misplaced trust. It was about fighting to protect her home, her children, and her peace, right up until her final moments. Even after Jermaine Cannon was convicted, the wounds left on Sharonda's family never truly healed. Her daughter expressed what so many felt, frustration that her mother's killer was given the respect and dignity Sharonda was denied. As she put it, he got to live practically another lifetime after her murder. She didn't get to pick her last meal. She didn't get to say goodbye to anybody. While they were relieved to see justice finally carried out, the execution felt, in some ways, like a slap in the face, an act that showed him more respect than he had ever shown Sharonda. Still, her family found solace in being able to speak for Sharonda when she no longer could. Tragically, Sharonda's mother did not live to witness the moment of justice being served. This case also highlights systemic issues within the correctional system. Sharonda's killing marked the second time in 5 months that a low-security inmate with a violent record had been accused of killing a woman after escaping. Larry Kenneth Jackson was serving a 30-year sentence for killing his girlfriend when he walked away from his work crew at the Capitol on September 6, 1994. It was alleged that Jackson went to an Oklahoma City motel the day following his escape with a new girlfriend and killed her with the box knife he used on his work crew job. Due to bed shortages in higher security prisons, dangerous criminals were often placed in less secure environments, leading to multiple escapes. Governor Frank Keating criticized the Department of Corrections for these lapses, emphasizing the need for stricter oversight and better resource allocation to prevent such incidents. What do you think drove Jermaine Cannon to commit such a heinous act against someone who had shown him nothing but compassion? Do you believe justice was fully served in this case? Was the death penalty the appropriate punishment? Or did his lengthy appeals process rob Sharonda's family of true closure? Let's continue the conversation down in the comments section below. As always, I'll meet you there. In these stories, there are no perfect victims, just imperfect individuals navigating different roles in life. Sharonda was more than a victim. She was a loving daughter, sister, aunt, niece, cousin, friend, and above all, a mother to two young girls whose lives have been forever changed by her loss. She will forever remain in the hearts of those who cherished and loved her, not because she was perfect, but because she was perfectly wonderful in their eyes. This is why I extend my gratitude to the victims for being beacons of love and light, despite any flaws that may emerge from their stories. So thank you, Sharonda, for being an example of love and light. May you rest in eternal peace. That wraps up this episode of Sleuthy Stories. Thanks for joining me as we uncover the twists and turns of real-life cases. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you have a moment, please leave a rating. It really helps more true crime fans find us. Want to see the visuals that go with today's case? You can find the full video version on my YouTube channel, Sleuthy Lucy. Check the link in the description. I'll be back soon with another case. But until then, keep your wits sharp and your curiosity sharper.